define self-esteem, and how do you define discipline? Let's take self-esteem first. Some ideas. What does it mean to you? Anyone? What is
feeling good about yourself?
Feeling good about yourself. What else?
Having pride in yourself.
Having pride in oneself. Even though we may have heard in those earlier years, pride goeth before a fall, it's important to be proud about yourself. I'll tell a story about that a little bit later. What are some other ways that you would describe self-esteem?
Esteem is like estimating, so it's how you estimate or value yourself.
I like that. How relating to estimating and how you estimate yourself, how you look at yourself, and come up with some bottom line. Okay. What about discipline? There's a chair right in there. What about discipline? How do you define discipline? It's a hard one, huh? Self-control? Pardon? I missed that one back here somewhere.
Training.
Okay. Discipline relates to the word disciple, which means to be a learner. And it's a learning. It's a teaching. To find a new way of improving. So we want to look at discipline in the positive sense of learning, not in the negative sense of hurting. You know, I'm giving you a spanking for your own good. Any of you heard that? In your own good? It hurts me more than it does you. Well, I think as we get into our adult life, very few of you would continue to work for bosses who disciplined you or changed your behavior by putting you over their knee and paddling you. There'd be a lot of sexual harassment cases, I'm sure, for women in that situation, or they would be, it would certainly be wise for them to do that. So we have to learn a new way of changing behavior when you get beyond that stage of being able to put someone over your knee. I could easily live in Sweden, which I understand has had for over 10 years a no spanking law, a national no spanking law. I'm eager to have Gertrude's daughter and her children are coming to visit later this week, and she lives in Sweden, so I'm going to be eager to hear really from someone who's lived within that some more information about it. But we want to look at self-esteem and discipline, and I did not put it under a label of parenting because I'm not going to speak just about discipline from the parent's role, but I think more in general of discipline, even as adult to oneself, adult to adult, child to child, adult to child, maybe even child to adult. So there are lots of other areas that we could deal with in discipline. That takes more than the 55 minutes that we have tonight. So we'll look at how does discipline affect how you feel about yourself. And there's going to be a lot of things put together. Because one basic way of looking at the discipline that you do in order to change behavior is to look at how we communicate. And there's three basic parts to communication. You probably have seen this kind of formula before, that if you were to divide communication into 100%, there's three basic components. One is body language, what your hand and body and head and, you know, what your body is saying, what you would get from the person even if you were deaf and could not hear their words. So we've got body language. A second part of how we communicate is the tone of voice. If I were to be here talking with lots of pauses in between with a lot of I'm sure half of you would walk out of this room within the first 5 minutes because it wouldn't sound as if I knew very much about what I was saying, or you'd get so bugged by the you knows, the or the okays that you'd be ready to crawl the wall and would escape to the outside. And if I were yelling at you, just screaming, you'd probably say, I don't have to take that. Exit stage right. Words come in there too. Now, I'm not sure whoever did this study. It's been used in a variety of places, and no one who's ever used it has been able to tell me of its origin either. But this is about what the percentage is. For body language, about 55%. For tone of voice, about 38%. Guess what that leaves for words? Am I right? Is that right? Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember when we first heard this, my husband said, and I spent all that time putting my sermon together, choosing the right words. Well, that's not to negate words. Words are very important. Even if I said with a great big hug to you and a great big smile on my face, go jump in the lake, you're not going to feel very good about it, are you? I mean, the words still have carry weight and carry an important message. But we might look at how we do communicate with ourselves. Do we say things, maybe not the tone of voice, but we may look heavier at those words and the kind of body language we may use that sort of beats ourselves, puts ourselves down. When you're talking to another person that you're really very angry at, I think there's a place for yelling. You can yell directions, you can yell what your expectations, you can yell your feelings, you can yell what you wish, what you need, but we don't have the right to really yell to put the other person down, to degrade, and to show disrespect to them, as if they don't have any brains at all. And I suppose one of the reasons why I think there's a lot more value in discipline in our use of words and our body language and our tone of voice as over against just the body language of paddling the behind is that our brains are up here in our heads, not down here where we're sitting. And when you paddle the behind, that's saying to the kid, this is where your brains are. This is the only way you can ever understand anything. And I'd like to move those brains back up to where they belong, which will also help them to say, hey, I'm okay. I am lovable and capable. I am worthwhile. And that's what we want to build, in a sense, in our self-esteem. Not that, boy, am I bigger and better than everybody else and you can all go jump in the lake. That's not self-esteem. That's really someone who perhaps thinks very, very poorly of oneself and feels the only way you can feel okay is to step on someone else, make them feel a little bit lower than you do. And that's not helpful for either of us, for them or for us. So we can look at the ways that we communicate to ourselves as well as to the other person as a point of discipline. What is it that we really want to say to the other person or ourselves? I do discipline courses, and I talk about 23 options for behavior management. And the last two times that I've run the course, and they go for 4 nights, 3 hours a night, a 12-hour course, I've had a couple of grandparents who've come in, and in another situation, a woman who's been in a couple of other classes of mine who I knew did not have children. And when we started talking about the basis for the course, they each said, oh, I didn't realize it was focused specifically on parenting. I really thought it might help me with my own self-discipline. So that's why we're looking now more specifically at discipline in general as it relates to the development of one's self-esteem or the enhancement or the erosion of one's self-esteem. Self-esteem that says to you, hey, I'm okay. I'm a child of God. I can be forgiven. I can forgive. I can love. I can be loved. I am capable. And I'm capable of learning. So that we can continue to grow. The lower our level of self-esteem is, the less likely we are to try out new possibilities, to open the door to new ways of thinking, to be less influenced by other people. And I think this is our great fear with teenagers particularly, and it's not just settled into the teenage years, it goes down to a lot lower grades right now, where kids feel they have to do things that everybody else will approve of so they can be accepted. It's not maybe not what they want to do, but that's what others expect them to do, and that's how they'll get loved. You're not loved for being, you're loved for doing what everybody else wants you to do, even if you know it's not in your best interest. So, how we can help build that self-esteem in ourselves as well as in those whose lives we touch helps them make better decisions, helps them focus on what needs to be done, helps freeze them to try something new and to revise those tapes, those messages that we may have gotten when we were little kids. I grew up in a rural family in southern Minnesota. My parents are farmers. My father was an alcoholic. And I had two older brothers and an older sister. And my brothers were old enough, so they were out of school by the time I started high school, away from our little, went 7 years to a one-room school in the community. But I can remember both my sister and I really saying, you know, everybody knows who our dad is. They see him frequently on Friday nights, Saturday nights in town and other times. We have to prove that we're someone else. And I'm not sure that was the most helpful for us. And I think my sister and I have worked through this in different ways. But we really felt that we only gained our self-esteem by what we did and by the grades we got. How high at the top of the class we can manage to be, or what chair in the band we managed to be. That was where we got our self-esteem, pleasing others. Fortunately, back in my days, we didn't have a lot of drugs and irresponsible sexuality in action, so that, in a sense, our peers kept us pretty straight. I think if we were going through our teenage years now, we would probably be very differently influenced. And I can give thanks I grew up in the age I did. But I was very aware when our daughters were growing up that I wanted them to make good decisions. I wanted them to be able to say no. And even though we live through horrendous times when our kids are 2, 3, and 4, and listening to all those no's, how many have kids here under the age of 4? Okay, and you're in the no stage or have gone through the no, I don't want to, I won't. One of the things you can do when you visualize them saying no, when you hear them saying no, is to visualize when they're 14 or 16 and they're saying no, when you really want them to say no. So we don't want to wipe out those no's from little kids and say, you do it because I say so. Because then, that's back to our communication. What is the sound of our voice? What is it telling them? You aren't very okay. You're just to be yelled at. It's not giving them information to grow on, but if somebody is bigger or more powerful than you are, then they can make you do what they want. And then we end up with a lot of sexually abused children who are afraid to tell. We end up with a lot of followers who get into trouble with the law and with their own bodies and with school and with perhaps what they put into their system in the form of drugs and chemical substances. So I think one of our major roles as a human being, as a parent, as a friend of someone, is to help that other person learn how to think, not just what to think. We need to help others, particularly our kids, learn how to think, not just what to think. That's scary for parents, because we want to tell them that they ought to follow my rules. My way or the highway. That's what a lot of parents tell me. Is it okay? You know, you have your right to do that, but what are you really teaching them? To follow whatever is that stronger outside voice. And when they get a little farther in school, they'll still be listening to that outside voice, only it's not going to be your outside voice any longer. It's going to be the peer group. What do you want them to follow? How do we teach them how to think so that they can make good decisions when we're not around? Because we're not going to be following them all the time. We're not going to be there as they're 6, 8, 10, 14, 16, 18, saying, no, no, you better not do that. Following them around in the cars, following them around in the hangouts for teenagers. wherever. We want to help to build that inner control that says, hey, you're okay. You are a child of God. You are lovable and capable. You can think about what's going to be in your best interest, what's going to be helpful. To think about options. Think about the choices you have. And never forget that you are okay. And when those decisions don't turn out to be the right ones, how do we help them to process them, to think through it so that they don't have to fall into that same pit a second time? What can they learn? Jack Canfield has a marvelous statement that I like. He says, you can't learn less. Well, I think you possibly could if you decide to blame somebody else for whatever has happened. If you decide to pretend nothing has happened, nothing's gone wrong, it's not your fault, or it's not my problem, or I just don't want to talk about it. We won't learn anything from that. We'll be doomed to make the same mistakes over and over and over again. But if we can look at it and recognize that even mistakes are great learning possibilities, we can gain some new ideas for how to deal with it next time and be a little bit better prepared. I mentioned in our earlier session on self-esteem, Edison was asked, weren't you extremely discouraged when it took you 1,400 tries to create the light bulb? And he said, nope, it was a 1,400-step process. I learned through each step what not to do again, what didn't work. And I finally found out what did work. So if we can help think about that ourselves, that each time we make a mistake, it's a learning experience, it's possibilities. It gives me an idea of where I can grow. So looking at what happens, instead of beating ourselves, pounding our forehead, shaking our fist at ourselves, beating our breast, or just plain going into a closet and closing the door saying, I'll never learn, or I'll never get it right, or whatever those other negative messages are, to say, what can I learn from this? How can it benefit me the next time I have that similar experience or a related experience? Another way we can focus on self-esteem and discipline is the little catchword, and it's one of the chapters in the self-esteem book, A Family Affair by Jean Ilse Clark, that says, who do we catch them being, and who do we tell them they are? Now, that's applicable to adults as well as to kids. Who do we catch them being, and who do we tell them they are? One of the exercises I have every parent do in a parenting class that they take is in the first session, take a piece of paper, and at the top of the paper, write acceptable behaviors, and halfway down the paper, write unacceptable behaviors. And I tell them, put this up on the inside of a cupboard door and keep a pencil somewhere nearby. And when your child, and you can do it for your partner, you can do it for yourself if you feel you really want to check on how well you're doing and what things you might want to change yourself. We can always grow. Anyway, whenever a child does something that you feel is affirmative, positive, helpful, write it down. Put down a couple words of what they did and put the initial of the child after it. If they've done something that's not so helpful, not so beneficial, not in their best interest, not in the best interest of the family, not in my own best interest if I'm doing it, put it down under unacceptable behaviors. As many parents who have done this, I have maybe one out of every 15 who will say the bottom list, the unacceptable behavior, is longer than the top list of acceptable behavior after they've done it. Before they do it, I'll ask them, which list do you think will be longer? And they'll all say the unacceptable behaviors. And that's what we tune into. We tune into what we think has to be changed. Who do we catch them being? Mischievous, in trouble, never following rules, never doing what they're supposed to be doing, never meeting our expectations. Well, what does that say to somebody who hears that? I can't ever do anything right, so why bother trying? Give up. And then we have a lot of parents or a lot of teachers who say, I can't get Johnny or Mary to even try something. And they'll say, I can't do it. Oh, no, no, I can't do that. No, I'll never learn. I don't know how to encourage them. Well, we may start by catching them being good, affirming their being. One of the nice things in the self-esteem book is that they have a listing there of what are the basic roles children need to play, people play in those early ages. For instance, the job of the 0 to 6 month old is to just be. They're learning a lot of different things, turnover, so forth. They need to learn to trust others and self. And then, what are some of the affirmations that we can give a child who's in that stage that says, hey, I love you. Your needs are okay with me. I'm glad you're a girl, or I'm glad you're a boy. Rather than saying, boy, we really were hoping for a girl this time, but now we got a third boy. You know, and how that message continues to be heard by this child who says, I shouldn't have been a boy. You have every right to be here. You have a right to exist. Those are some of the affirmations to give that young child. The job of the 6 to 18 month old is doing. It tears our hair out and it uses up all our patience and energy, but that's the job of the 6 to 18 month old to do, to learn. They don't learn from words that you say, basically. Their mode of learning is by experiencing it. That's why they try to bite the electric cord and why they try to put things in the plug, why you need to put caps on outlets. To see what something is hot. They'll learn much more by feeling something. It's not exactly burning, but it's close to being warm that they recognize what. They have no idea what the word hot is until they connect it with a feeling. But we want to guide them in that connection that's not going to be a damaging one. We don't line up all little kids on the street corner and say, don't cross the street because you might get run over. Okay, Sammy, you run out and show us in front of that truck. I mean, we get in trouble with a child family service for abuse. You know, there are certain things that we have to take responsibility for. So the job of the 6 to 18-month-old is doing. And some of the affirmations, some of the things we might think about in that whole area of promoting self-esteem and how we look at our discipline for them is that you don't have to do tricks to get strokes. You don't have to be cutesy, do a dance, say a couple words, and you know, in order for me to accept you. You are accepted. You are lovable. Our love ought to be unconditional, not conditional on doing tricks, being cute, being stupid, being happy. Smile, and then I'll give you a hug. You know, as if they've got to pay for the hug with a smile. The smile will come after the hug. Or that they have to be fragile or tough. Boys have to be tough. Girls can be sweet little things, and then we'll love them. You don't have to do tricks to be loved. You are lovable. The job of the 3 to 6-year-old is to learn who she or he is. That's understanding who I am. What's my identity? What can I do? How am I accepted? Information about the world and about other people that helps me understand. And also learning acceptable behavior. How we give them that information about acceptable behavior comes through how we communicate it. Do we give them information both in action as well as in a sound of voice that they would be willing to listen to, or the sound of voice that turns them off and just says, I'm not going to listen. You can't make me do that. If you're going to be mean to me, I'll be mean back to you. Revenge is in a young child's vocabulary. I think they learn that fairly quickly because they experience it. The area of 6 to 12 is to do things in their own way, to begin to take responsibility and to understand what's going on. What is the social order of the world? What can I do? What's not acceptable for me to do? And in that area of structuring, learning to do things our own way, some of the things, affirmations are, you can think before making that rule your own. How do we encourage children to think through what's, well, yeah, that's what's, instead of saying, don't you listen to them, to say, well, yeah, I guess you could listen to them. If you did, what might happen? If you didn't, what might happen? And those are things we can say to ourselves whenever we're confronted with an issue. Instead of saying, well, as a man, I've got to do this, or as a woman, I've got to do this, to say, well, what are my choices? If I did this, what would happen? If I didn't do it, what would happen? To learn problem solving, to learn the process of thinking through. And we can help children fairly young. I teach parents a problem-solving method that they can begin to use with three-year-olds that works. You know, yeah, what are your feelings about this? What are your needs? What are my needs? How do you suppose we can solve this? What are some of the, what can we do? Well, they may come up with very far, outrageous kind of possibilities, but they're thinking, and that's what you want to encourage them to do. Think. Yeah, and even if they do, they don't want an older brother around. Send them off out of the country. Send them off to grandma's. Okay. We could send them. If we did that, what might happen? How do you think it would help? Well, to look at this, there's cause and effect. There's generally consequences to each of our actions, and we can begin to teach kids at an early age that there are consequences. We can begin to learn that ourselves if we're attempting to stop smoking, and then we're tempted by a friend to take a couple of puffs on their cigarette, and then we're back into smoking again. I mean, that's, well, there are some consequences for us. Another affirmation is that you can trust your feelings to help you to know. How do we get in tune with our feelings and to begin to own them, whether we're in that age of 6 to 12 or whether it's recycled and we're thinking about it again, whatever our age is, because we recycle through these stages again. We recycle through the stage of doing and thinking and learning about our own identity at various stages in our life. And how do we help ourselves as well as others to be comfortable with their own feelings? One way is to acknowledge their feelings. Oh, you're feeling pretty uncomfortable about that, or that must have been extremely embarrassing to you. That's uncomfortable. Once we recognize the feeling and you have it accepted, you can feel free to go on to doing something else about it. You don't have to protect it so much and become so undone by it that you can't let go. We have responsibility for our feelings to a greater extent than we ever want to recognize. It's not in your hands. You don't have a remote control for my feelings. I don't have a remote control for your feelings. I don't have a crystal ball. I can only check out if what I think I see on your face and in your actions and in the tone of your voice, what you must be feeling. And if I guess wrong, then you can correct me and get me back on the right track. That's marvelous, helpful, two-way communication. If someone comes in and just goes dragging and flopping down in a chair, and I say, boy, you're just worn out. You've had a terribly rough day. And they say, no, I didn't have a rough day. I just realized now I forgot, and it went through so quickly and easily, and I really had plenty of time, but I completely forgot one important thing, and I'm trying to figure out how to pick up the pieces. Well, you know, that gives me a whole different focus on it, doesn't it? Wouldn't it for you? That you get on, you're on a different, you'd be heading off this way saying, well, they're too tired, I'm not even going to talk with them, I'll just let them be on their own. Whereas the other person may really be saying, hey, I need to throw out some ideas, I need to get some feedback and some possibilities, and here you're ignoring them because you thought they were just too tired. So it's important to check out what feelings are. It's okay to own your own feelings. And when you own them, then you have to take responsibility for sharing that feeling with the other person, saying, if what you really are feeling is exhausted, tired, to say, yeah, I am, and I need 5 minutes of peace and quiet before anything is asked of me. I just need to get my head back together, and then give me 5 minutes, and then I'll be ready to enter the world. Otherwise, I think I'm going to be yelling, short-tempered, and disagreeable. Well, I think we have a right to be, to recognize what's going on within us. Our feelings are okay. Feelings aren't right or wrong. Feelings are okay. We have a choice as to how we act on them. I may feel extremely irritated, annoyed, frustrated with somebody, but I don't have the right to punch him in the nose. I can tell him, when you call me names, I really feel embarrassed and put down and feel disrespected. Especially when it's done in front of a group of people. If you want to say something to me, tell it to me in private, please. You know, that might help each of us to learn a little bit about the other. Job of the 13 to 19-year-old is to separate from the family. That's about the time we began to say, oh, come in closer. And they've probably said, you know, stand back. I've got to test out some things. Anything that can happen after 18 can happen before 8 now with most kids. So the time isn't really that much of a problem. And some of the affirmations for that particular age is that you can think before you act. You can think before you make that rule your own. Back to processing again. What are the benefits? What are the negatives? Help us to think through that ourselves, whatever our age is. If I do this, what will happen? If I do something else. It's okay to know who you are is another affirmation for that stage. And a lot of us go through this. I sometimes say that I'm not sure. I've done a variety of things in my years. And there are times I still think back to all the messages I heard when I was a little kid and that I thought I heard other people say. You know, it's not what we think is going on. It's not what other people think that's going on. It's what we think they think about what's going on. And that can be awfully misleading. And I've often said, I think I was probably 50 before I began to like myself. Well, I think I did at earlier ages, but I think I like myself a little bit better since then than I did before. I had a lot more doubts. It's okay to know who you are. What are some of your strong points and what are some of your weak points? And to say, hey, I can do that. I'm okay. Still have to learn a little bit more about such and such, but, you know, I feel pretty comfortable and confident about this. And I can share that as a gift with you. And you can share your gift with me. And we can learn from each other. You can change yourself, but you can't change someone else. They choose whether they want to follow your request, listen to what you've said. It's all a choice. And it depends to a great extent on what I call the balance you have in your goodwill bank. You know, you balance out, how many of you balance out a checkbook with some regularity? Okay. Ever think about balancing out your goodwill bank? You know, what's the ratio of criticism to affirmation with each person with whom you have a relationship? If you have kids, with each child, if it's just with your partner or just with a friend, what's the ratio? We sometimes have a better balance in the goodwill bank with friends than we have with our own family. Because with friends, you're always on your... You want to keep them friends. Family, they're there. You're stuck with them, and they're stuck with you. Yeah, we sometimes kick them out. What is it, Robert Frost? Is it Robert Frost that said, "Home is where when you go there, they have to take you in."
Yeah.
I'm a little uncomfortable with that. I mean, they want to take you in, not have to take you in. But what's the balance in that goodwill bank? That's what determines to a great extent whether the discipline, the change in behavior modification, the behavior management, the teaching, the learning that goes on under the word of discipline, that's where it all gets determined. If there's a good amount of goodwill there, the other person will quite likely say, well, yeah, they're reasonable with me. Yeah, I'll do that. I can change. And you're encouraging them. They become encouraged to change themselves. You can't change them. You can't reach inside and reprogram their buttons. You can turn around and head them in another direction, but they may turn around just as quick and head back as you can, as many of you have had experiences with 2 and 3 year olds. They have a mind of their own. I hear a lot of parents around the village calling to a little kid, come here, and the little kid just keeps going off in the other direction even farther. In a sense, challenging. Do you really mean what you're saying? And if they've had the experience that they know you'll call them 3 or 4 times and then you'll give up, they're not going to come back. They've learned a very quick lesson that you've had no idea you were teaching and how well you were teaching it just from their own experience. Mom will say, come on back, or stop this, but I can get away with it most of the time. And even that 1 or 2 times that dad or mom really does stop me, that's okay, because more of the times I can get away with it. So it's worth being checked that once or twice. Say what you mean what you say what you mean, and do what you said you were going to do. It was a marvelous phrase for really using discipline with children. If you say stop, and they keep on going, and you just say the words, you may have to put actions with it and move them away. Sometimes we have to say that to ourselves. And if you're tempted with a big ice cream sundae, then maybe it's best for you to get out of the village center by the back door instead of going out the door that's by the soda fountain where the ice cream is. Head up toward the cafeteria and get a cup of tea or a cup of coffee instead if you really need to stay away from the ice cream. If you're really trying to stop smoking, maybe we have to find somebody else to talk with during those times when your friends are smoking so that you aren't tempted to be there and smoke along with them. An alcoholic may have to find some new friends during those weak times when they're not able to say to themselves yet, hey, I can still be with people who may be drinking and have coffee or have soda instead of alcohol. We have to begin to understand our limitations and set some goals for ourselves. Set the limits for our kids. Set the limits for those with whom we have the interactions. One of the things that's really delightful in our in living in our area of Canada is that we were very impressed with in the very beginning is that most people take off their shoes when they enter your house, adults as well as kids. And I used to be so irritated when we were living in Massachusetts and we'd get snow, but not as heavy as in where we used to live in New York State. And kids would come in with their hiking boots and keep their hiking boots on. You know, hiking boots with all those creases and crevices that just packed all the snow in, and then you'd end up with puddles of water all over the place in it finally. Some people we could say, shoot, this is a no-shoe house. But that, in when we moved to Waterloo, that was just, they walk in, the shoe, there's a whole pile up of shoes by the door. You have one wet place instead of all over. What do we set as limits? Do you know what the limits are? If you were to ask your children, or whoever else lives in the household with you, even if it's other adults, what are our household limits? You might be surprised at what each one will think. So being aware of what our own limits are, and asking for people's help in meeting those limits if I have difficulty in meeting them. If I need some support or some strength to be able to ask for, it's okay to ask for help. You can still be powerful and ask for help. No one expects anyone to be a world unto his or her own. We don't live in a completely independent world. No one. You don't raise all your own wheat and grind it into flour and make your own bread. I mean, we grind flour here at the village, but we don't raise it. So we depend upon other people for a variety of needs. It's okay to even ask in some other areas that these needs are not expected or experienced. So asking for needs and looking at what are some of the affirmations that I need. I think particularly for family members, for partners, for even good friends, to say to that family member, that partner, I need help with. This has been a terrible, horrible, very bad, no good day. Anyone know this marvelous little book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day? Is it Judith Yorst? Great. It's for adults as well as for kids. To say, this has been a terrible day. I just need some nurturing. I need somebody to say, hey, you're okay. I need to be renewed rather than just sitting there grouchy. And it might be helpful to tell our kids that, too. It's okay to let us know how you feel. I won't know what your needs are until you tell me. And then how we respond back to them in our body language. As we say, boy, that's a stupid thing, kind of thing. Or I roll our eyes when we hear what they're feeling again. You know, rather than taking them seriously, those are their feelings and their needs, and that's an important part of them. I can accept them. They don't have to feel the way I want them to feel. Accepting them allows them to take that first step for them to change toward a feeling that might be more comfortable for them. I can't change their feeling by saying, stop worrying, stop whining, stop. You can tell them that, but it's not going to do any good. It just uses your energy up, puts them down, makes them, produces a feeling within the child. It doesn't make them feel anything. We choose how we feel. Eleanor Roosevelt said a long time ago, no one can make you feel inferior without your permission. And I think that still holds. We choose a good amount of the feelings that we have. Sadness or joy may come spontaneously, but there may be reasons for that. But if we feel really put down by someone, we may have to think, why am I taking those words as negatives? Is there something else? Is it appropriate? Do I have a problem that I need to deal with? And we may need to recognize who owns the problem. Do I own the problem? Does the other person? Do we share it? How do we pick it apart to figure out whose responsibility is what? That helps us to assume responsibility for our own needs, our own feelings, and then for our own self-esteem. You can't make me feel good. Marvelous to see a room full of people. And I'm delighted that this is a topic that intrigues, interests some people as to dealing with self-esteem and discipline. I could go out of here still feeling, if I choose to feel sad about something else that might be, I might be dealing with within me about being sad, or you aren't making me feel. I choose to feel delighted, pleased, excited that somebody did come. Issue of power and control is another one that I think is very influential in self-esteem and discipline. Do we feel I have to be in control all the time? Or that you're responsible for your needs and I'm responsible for my needs? How can we help each other meet each other's needs? It doesn't have to be my way or the highway. I think a lot of I'm sure I had those feelings at times in my parenting role. And when I finally learned that I can teach my children how to think, not just what to think, it was a whole burden off my shoulders. I don't have to stand there and pound things into their head. I can give them some information. I can teach them how to do some problem solving, looking at choices, help them to process what's happened. But I don't have to take responsibility for everything they do wrong. I don't also take responsibility for everything they do right. And the story I would tell later was when our older daughter was 12 and she moved into junior high, she came home one of the first marking periods with an outstanding report card, stunning. And her father said to her, Anna, I'm so proud of you. And she looked back at him with her big blue eyes and said, Dad, you can be happy, pleased, excited, delighted for me, but I can be proud of what I did. I did all the studying for those tests. I wrote the exams. I wrote the reports. I had to stand up in class and talk when I didn't want to. And I had to go to school, walk to school on those days that I didn't want to do. I can be proud of my report card. Well, that was an eye-opener for us. And ever since then, we've been saying, oh, I'm delighted to hear. You must be proud of yourself. Let the feeling of pride stay with the doer. Now, I'm delighted and happy and very pleased with what our two daughters are doing. And I could say, I really want to be very proud of them, but they own that feeling because they've done it. They've had to learn from the things that they've had to learn and continue and the things that they're continuing in. I can be excited for them and delighted and pleased. To affirm their doing, their responsibility taking, their initiative, to encourage them, even in the process. Don't wait until they're all finished. Our older daughter is finishing, Anna, who got the report, outstanding report card, is finishing her doctorate in linguistics at the University of Chicago. Now, if we waited until she had it in her hand, that's 5-6 years process. I mean, you need to give that each step along the way. And now, we know that that kind of degree is a long step process. And we say, oh, sure, then you can give encouragement along the way. But even what the little things that our children are doing, even if it's writing a paragraph, which may be much more difficult for them and at their level than it is might be for us, to give them encouragement. Boy, you've at least got the pencil and paper together. You're getting some thoughts together. I'm sure you can do it before they even start or even after they get the first word down. That's the first word is the hardest, isn't it? Encouragement, not praise. Oh, what a good kid you are. What a good student because you're getting down finally doing your homework. Anyone feel very excited about that kind of encouragement? Now, finally? That's a judgment. Okay. Well, encouragement can be more than just words. It includes touch. That pat on the back, the shaking of the hand, the hug, the squeeze. It can also include giving attention to the person, listening, summing up, putting together in a word what you're hearing them say, which helps very much to check out again if you've got the right message. You may be going off this direction and they're really heading that way. So you may want to checkpoint again. And that's very helpful. So, who do we catch them being? How do we look at what's going on and give them encouragement and build up that balance in the goodwill bank? Not just criticism, but affirmations. Encouragement. Who do we tell them they are? Do we tell them that they are indeed lovable and capable? We all have things to learn, and this is a hard part at this particular stage to learn. And for the 2 and 3 year old, that no is a stage that's one of the first words kids will learn. We think that they learn ma and da, mama and dada first, but they really learn no first, I think. Sometimes I think they learn it in the womb. But that's to be encouraged, too, that you're knowing how to make some decisions, even if it may not be the one I want you to make. That sometimes it's okay to disagree. Right now, and you may also, they may be saying no even when they want to do it, so when they're at that stage, and you may be able to turn them around and find another way of getting them to do it. We often tell kids and others what not to do, even with adults. It may also be helpful to tell them what to do. And I've heard someone say, I think it's Jean Elsie Clark that says, you ought to tell them 2 positives for every negative. That gives them a choice. It's not just telling them what to do, it gives them a choice among possibilities that you're willing to allow. And then they feel they've got a little bit more power, a little bit more control. And they learn that there's some choices. There's always choices. I'd like to have a couple minutes for questions, but there's one piece that I'd like to close with first that gets back to this whole area of our communication and what we say and how it's taken by the other person. Whether it becomes discipline or whether it becomes disrespect. And some of you may have heard this. It's Irma Bombeck, marvelous person with words. On TV the other day, a leading child psychologist said parents should treat their children as they would treat their best friend, with courtesy, dignity, diplomacy. I've never treated my children any other way, I told myself. But later that night, I thought about it. Did I really talk to my best friends like I talk to my children? Just suppose our good friends Fred and Eleanor came to dinner one night and, well, it's about time you two got here. What have you been doing, dawdling? Leave those shoes outside, Fred. Were you born in a barn? And shut the door. So, Eleanor, how have you been? I've been meaning to have you over for such a long time. Fred, take it easy on the chip dip or you'll ruin your dinner. I didn't slave over a hot stove all day for you to eat like a bird. Heard from any of the gang lately? Got a card from the Martins. Yes, they're in Lauderdale again. They go every year to the same spot. What's the matter with you, Fred? You're fidgeting. Of course you have to go. Look at all that punch you drank. The bathroom's up down the hall, the first door on the left. And I don't want to see a towel on the floor when you're finished. Did you wash your face before you came, Eleanor? See a dark spot around your mouth? Oh, I guess it's a shadow. So how are the children? If you ask me, I think summer school is a great place for them. Well, now, is everybody hungry? Then why don't we go into dinner? You can all wash up, and I'll take up the food. Don't tell me your hands are clean, Eleanor. I saw you playing with the dog. Fred, you sit over there, and Eleanor, you sit with the half a glass of milk. You know how you're all elbows when it comes to milk. There now, your host will say grace. Fred, I don't see any cauliflower on your plate. Have you tried it? Well, try a spoonful. If you don't like it, I won't make you finish it. But if you don't try it, you can just forget about dessert. Now sit up straight, or your spine will grow that way. Now, what were we talking about? Oh, yes, the Gerbers. They sold their house. I mean, they took a beating, but... Eleanor, stop talking with food in your mouth. I can't hear a word you're saying. And use your napkin. At that moment in my fantasy, my son walked into the room. How nice of you to come, I said pleasantly. Now what did I do, he sighed. Think about it. What about our tone of voice? What about our body language? What about the words we use that helps or hinders in that process of growing towards self-esteem and in the learning about ourselves and the world around us? Questions, comments, anyone? Yes?
I always thought that I heard so often people say, this kid is such a horrible child. I can't do anything with him. Yeah. Right in front of him. Oh, believe me, he's going to keep on being a horrible child.
That's right. If you can't be the best at being the best, you might as well be the best at being the worst.
Yeah, that's right. And then they think, she can't do anything.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mom says she can't do anything with you. Oh, boy, do I have it made. I can do whatever I want.
And at least I used to hear that so often.
Yeah. Catch kids being good. I like, isn't there an old saying, you can catch more flies with honey than you can with vinegar? I mean, I think you can encourage more people with positives than you can with just criticism and negatives.
I read someplace years ago that Eskimo children are such good children because they believe they shouldn't tell their children that they're bad. They should always tell their children that they're good. And then the child believes that he's good and he'll be good.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who was a principal in Alaska, whenever there was a substitute in the classroom, one assignment for her or him was to leave a note with the principal as to which child or children helped the teacher the most, the substitute. And then he either called the home or wrote a note home. And he changed the whole attitude of substitutes coming to a school because the children wanted to help rather than...
Because then they got encouragement and an affirmation if mom got a call, not because they did something wrong, but I just want to tell you that the substitute really felt encouraged and helped by your child today. Wow, wouldn't you want to hear that? Either yourself or about your child. The positives are important. Remember the balance in your goodwill bank. there'll always be negatives. Because nobody is perfect, and nobody always follows the rules the way that every, you know, that others may feel that they are. And we can learn in the process, but we don't have to be cut down. We don't have to be disparaged or discarded because we've done something wrong. That feeling of I'm still okay, even if I've made a mistake, because I can learn from the mistake, so I don't have to make it again next time.
Something that I want—I mean, when all this is said in this kind of context, I just kind of say, "Well, of course, this makes a lot of sense, and I'll do that." And yet, when I'm in an emotionally charged situation, it's harder to do that. And I'm just wondering if you found things that helps in terms of reactivity to kind of get into that space when I'm not feeling like it.
Yeah, and I was there was a note I had on this. Part of it is to not let my self-esteem be tied up with the successes or non-successes of my child or my partner or my parent. Now, I'd been a lot better off if I said, you know, I'll do what I can do. My father's doing the best he can do. I don't have to carry my father's burden on me. And so, yeah, I can be very pleased when a child comes home with A's and very discouraged when they come home with C's and say, I must be a terrible parent because now they've changed or whatever's happened. You know, say, well, gee, what's going to look at what's happening with the child instead of, well, look at what you're doing to me. So to take responsibility for our own self-esteem and not let it be, that's the words I'm looking for, not let it be determined by my child. Or by my partner. I mean, my partner doesn't need to bear the burden of my self-esteem as well as his own. I can take responsibility for mine. It's nice to have support. It's nice to have encouragement and affirmation. But I'm basically responsible for who I am. My husband is responsible for who he is. We share and cooperate in a variety of things and fill in for where each one has a skill that may complement the other. But I don't have to be a certain way just to make him feel good. And I think we might encourage our kids, they'll do some things that we may not be the happiest with. I'm still okay, and they're still okay. We have to work on changing this behavior. And to say to the child, even if they're three on up, boy, we've got a problem here. What can we do about it? This isn't working right. And to look at how we solve the problem rather than they start to whine, we start to fuss because we feel hopeless, helpless, discouraged, puzzled. And then we're mad at them because they're feeling bad about something. And we've used up our energy. They still haven't felt any better about it. They feel even worse. And we're both behind the eight ball. Rather than saying, boy, things just aren't going well for you right now. What are your needs? Or I can't allow you to do this right now. I'm sorry. You really want to, but that's not something I can allow. You can be mad at your brother, but I can't allow you to hit him or hurt him. Because a basic rule in our house is that people and living things aren't for hurting. I think that ought to be a basic rule in every house, and that means then we have to find some way else to deal in our behavior change with kids other than spanking or slapping hands. Because what we're teaching then is if you're bigger, it's okay to hit. And hitting violence gets your way. And if we ever say, I'm doing this only because I love you, then they get it confused that violence is a way of showing love. Those are some of the last things we want to teach our kids. But if we can say, I'm still an okay parent, I'm still an okay partner, I'm an okay friend, I'm sorry my friend isn't, or my child or my partner isn't feeling very good, how can I acknowledge their feelings and help them deal with it? Or if it's a problem for a younger child that we, under the age of three, we really have to take more responsibility for, you may just have to pick them up, turn them around, and move them. And redirect them. Give them something else to do. Or remind them of what the rule is, remind the timeout. There's a whole bunch of other things we can deal with in parenting, which we will do some more courses on this next week, more specifically with young children. But I think if we can begin to tune into ourselves and still say, I'm okay, even if my child is fussing, my child is still okay, we have to figure out a way to change that behavior and look at it as problem solving. We have something else to go to. Thank you.